I'm Joe Palca, a correspondent on the Science Desk at NPR.
And I'm Chris Joyce, also a correspondent at the Science Desk at NPR.
And you're listening to On Science.
We're going to start this week's podcast with something from Joe.
Yes, it's a story about a condition, it's a brain condition called amblyopia. You've heard of it?
Yeah.
It's also known by the word lazy eye.
Yep, my daughter had it when she was born, and you had it too.
I had it, and there's about a million Americans who have a form of it. And one of the consequences is that you lose the ability to see things in three dimensions. So I went to the University of California at Berkeley, where they're doing some work on this, and I did a story about it.
Let's hear it.
I've known all my life that I have this vision problem that's hard for people to understand. And the reason it's tricky is that there's nothing wrong with my eyes. There's something wrong with my brain. You see, what happened was I was born cross-eyed, one eye turned in. And my brain then got two images of the world, and that didn't make any sense, so my brain just suppressed one of the images. Well, I had surgery to straighten out the eye, so I look reasonably normal. But my brain never figured out how to see two images at once, and that left me with a problem.
Hi, Joe.
Yeah, Dennis
Levi.
Hi.
Come on in.
We're in the office of Dennis Levi. He's dean of the optometry school at Berkeley. His lab is small and cluttered. The furniture is old. There's an eye chart taped to the wall.
Let's just see what you can see.
My problem is seeing things in 3D, what optometrists call stereo vision. To test my stereo vision, Levi hands me a book with a picture of a fly and tells me to put on a pair of glasses like the kind you get in 3D movies.
Can you grab the fly's wings?
To me, it looks just like a picture of a fly, so I touch the page with my fingers.
Pretty much flat on the page. They're not sticking out.
No, not at all.
You are essentially stereo blind.
In other words, my brain is incapable of getting an image from both eyes simultaneously and fusing them to get a sense of three dimensions. For people with stereo vision, the fly looks very different. To prove it, Levi hands the book to my producer, Jane Greenhalgh.
I've got the magic glasses on.
Yeah. Can you grab the creepy fly's wings?
Oh, yeah. The fly's wings are right up here.
Jane is grasping at a spot about 2 inches above the page. Traditional wisdom says past age 7 or so, if brain paths crucial for vision aren't working, they'll never work. But Levi is part of a growing number of researchers who think you can teach an old brain new tricks. And he thinks he can help me with this stereo blindness problem. His colleague Susanna Chung takes me over to a box with two prisms mounted in front of a video screen. The idea is to adjust the prisms until two white boxes on the screen are superimposed.
So now, how many squares can you see?
I see two. There's one over here and there's one over there.
Can you get them closer by turning the knobs?
I twiddle the knobs, but the two boxes stay stubbornly apart. If I could fuse them, it would be the first step in establishing stereo vision. Of course, if you've already got stereo vision, it's easy. Once again, Jane demonstrates.
I mean, I can definitely see two squares, and now I see one square. Oh, Joe, this is so easy, I'm sorry.
And yet I persevere.
Then the question is, how much can the brain do? Is there a chance with work that I could get to the point where I could see with both eyes?
It's possible.
Levi encourages me to call a famous patient with an eye problem similar to mine. Hi, is this Sue Berry?
Yes, it is.
Sue Berry is probably the most famous amblyopia patient in America. There were profiles of her in New Yorker magazine and on NPR. Like me, she was born with a crossed eye. But working with optometrists, she was able to do the equivalent of fusing the boxes, and now she has full stereo vision. I asked her what that felt like. She said the world has a sense of space it never had before.
A sense of space and a sense of immersion in that space, and that's what stereo vision gave me. It's this incredible sense of being immersed in the space around you, as opposed to sort of being looking in on it from a slight distance away.
How hard was it?
To gain stereo vision?
Yeah.
I went through procedures for about a year.
And was it worth it?
Absolutely. It was a complete revelation in what I could see.
That was really fascinating. But one of the things I would like to know more about is what exactly did this woman who had her eyes were corrected, what did she have to do?
She did a lot of exercises, and she described some of them to me, but they basically involve
practicing looking at points in space and trying to make both eyes. It's sort of like in the piece you heard me trying to fuse the images with
the two boxes.
With the two boxes. She had a version of that kind of practice thing, and she would have to come back and work on it. In fact, she told me that the first time she was able to fuse the images, they were an image very close to her nose. So the closer to her face the image was, the easier it was for her to fuse them and get this three-dimensional sense.
Mm. And the other thing that occurred to me when I listened, Joe, was, and has occurred to me before, since I've known you for many years, is how do you know what you can't know? How do you know what you're missing?
Well,
I mean, I know maybe you can't shoot three-point baskets very well.
Well, no, I'm terrible at that. And you know, another game I'm really bad at is you can find the sports that I'm terrible at. I mean, apart from the fact that I'm kind of uncoordinated, are ones where you have to pick something out of space, like a tennis ball. So it's very hard for me to judge when a tennis ball is coming at me so that I can hit it at the exact right moment. But the interesting thing is, and it was really nice, I just got an email from my graduate advisor in graduate school who heard the piece, and we did vision psychology of vision together. Most of the things we know about the world, the sense of space in the world, comes from two dimensions, not three dimensions, because most of the things are further away than your eyes can make into a 3D image. So, for example, I know you're sitting in front of that clock simply because your face is obscuring part of the clock. So your brain learns all these rules about things go.
Your own set of rules.
Right.
Yeah. It reminds me of something, I don't know if you've ever read a book called Flatland.
Yeah. I've seen it.
It's a fascinating book written in the 19th century. It was basically a critique of Victorian society, but all the characters were geometric shapes.
Yeah.
Women were single lines. The low-class men were triangles.
Right.
Priests were circles because it's a more perfect form. But one of the themes of the book was that beings from one of the other dimensions had no idea about the others because they couldn't conceive of something they'd never seen.
Right. And I've tried to come up with the analogy for what I don't have. And the best one I've come up with so far is the fact that you can listen to something, you can listen to the radio in mono, but when you suddenly hear the same thing in stereo, you get a completely different effect. You get a sense of space in the room that you didn't have. So it's the same sounds and the same words and the same information, but a different feeling. So maybe that's the comparison.
Well, speaking of sound, there's a piece we're going to hear a little later about mosquito sound.
Yes,
that does exactly that thing.
I'm slaving away on these serious science stories, and you're talking about mosquitoes.
Hey, this is important
and
amazing. You know, sometimes scientists do very strange things that sound ridiculous. Take, for example, anesthetizing two mosquitoes and gluing each one to a string, actually, a tether. And when those mosquitoes wake up, well, we're going to hear neurobiologist Ron Hoy explain what happened then.
We tethered a female, got her flying, and then took a tethered male and brought the male within a couple of centimeters of the flying female, and then the interaction would begin.
The interaction being, well, no, not what you think, not at first anyway, the female mosquito of the species Aedes aegypti will not mate with just any male who flies by. First, the male must produce the right flight tone. That's the sound made by his beating wings.
When the male now is brought close to the female, what we see is an acoustic interaction. There's going to be variation in the flight tones. The male will adjust whatever he's been doing to bring about a match.
What they do is vary the pitch of their flight tones until they're a perfect duet. The male's pitch is at about 600 cycles per second, the female's a little lower at 400 cycles per second. In music, he's roughly a D and she's about a G. And then something very special happens. If you listen closely, you can detect a third tone, an overtone in musical terms, fainter, more ghostly than the two main mosquito tones, up at 1,200 cycles per second. Okay, it's no Madam Butterfly, but hey, these are bugs. The important thing is, once the mosquitoes detect this overtone, they mate. At his laboratory at Cornell University, Hoy tested this by creating just the 1,200 hertz overtone with audio equipment. When he played it for mosquitoes, they responded to it.
The interesting thing about mosquitoes is that, you know, if you're tone deaf, you're going to be squat out of luck, aren't you? because you're not going to catch that modulation. So I think this is pretty amazing stuff.
And mysterious. Why would mosquitoes do this? Hoy says producing the perfect pitch might be some kind of proof of male mosquito macho. Certainly singing for sex isn't that unusual in animals. Rex Cocroft, a behavioral biologist at the University of Missouri, has recorded lots of bugs doing that, but he says the mosquito duet is one of a kind.
We think of insects as being masters of timing and rhythm and not so much masters of pitch.
Now, humans are also masters of pitch, and some scientists wonder whether we learned some musical rules by listening to animals, even mosquitoes.
So, for example, when people were writing those early melodies like Gregorian chant, well, when you have a large jump up in frequency, then you tend to drop down stepwise. And people are asking, well, do animals show similar kinds of rules?
If that sounds crazy, consider this. The interval between the male mosquito's tone and the female's is quite close to what musicians call a perfect fifth. In fact, composers for centuries have considered the interval of a fifth to be the most euphonious. So, if mosquitoes have it right, all you need to do is find a melody with an interval of a fifth, and you're guaranteed romantic success.
Feelings. Nothing more than feeling.
The Cornell team's research appears in this week's issue of the journal Science.
Trying to forget my feelings of love.
And I got to tell you, all week long, there's been this annoying buzzing sound coming from Chris's desk as he shows everybody in NPR and anybody who has the misfortune to walk by, and we're constantly hearing, very attractive.
Oh, because you don't stick around long enough to hear the harmonic convergence.
I'm still scratching. So now we move from mosquitoes to fish. Why not? And joining us in the studio is NPR's Richard Harris, who's been out fishing, haven't you, Richard?
Well, at least watching people fish.
Okay, so why did you go to California? What's the deal with fishing in California?
Well, California has been grappling with how to deal with overfishing, which is a huge problem in many parts of the world and becoming less and less a problem in the United States because we've gotten regulations in place that pretty well have drawn back overfishing. We're now getting to maybe another problem, which is that one way California has dealt with overfishing is 2/3 of all fishermen have quit. So the fishing industry, they've basically been forced out because the economics just isn't there to support that big an industry.
Sounds good for the fish, though.
It's good for the fish. And the question is how to maintain a balance between making sure there are enough fishermen to have a little fishing industry maintained, enough fish for us to eat, and also enough fish in the ocean left to make sure that they're not over-harvesting fish. So I went out to the Northern California coast and talked to fishermen to figure out how they're trying to balance all those needs and requirements.
Okay, well, we're going to hear that piece. But for those of you, this is a part two of a two-part series that Richard did. And you can go to the website and hear part one, which is all about the Dungeness crab catch, which is also a very interesting piece. But now, part two.
There's a bustle of activity at the Kaito Fish Processing Plant tucked away in Fort Bragg, California. Crab boats are unloading their writhing catches, and huge crates of flatfish are being dumped out and shoveled onto a conveyor belt. It's a scene of great bounty from the sea. Jim Kaito watches happily as some 75 people crack crabs, sharpen their knives, and slice and skin fish in his cool and spacious plant.
We are in our fillet room. Fillet and picking room. They're playing ground fish right now, packing it for fresh market. They're playing Dover sole right now.
So this is sort of an assembly line, because it looks like, are those the sole up there, sort of the whole fish?
Those are the whole fish that they're filleting. You could call it assembly line. It's a fillet, well,
or
you know.
It's assembly line, I guess.
Yeah, it's a fillet line is what you call it.
The fish will be packed and trucked south to San Francisco and points beyond, where these succulent fillets are sought and savored as part of a healthy diet. The bustle is a scene Jim Kaito's father enjoyed, and his grandfather, and his great-grandfather, who arrived on these shores in the late 1880s.
Our ancestors came over from Italy, landed in San Francisco, and they were processing ground fish, and we've just kind of followed suit. Family business. As a kid, I filleted.
And you still have all your fingers.
Uh-huh. I got a few cuts, but I still have all my fingers.
Step out on the dock in front of Kaito's, though, and things don't look so bountiful. Up and down the harbor are empty buildings. 30 years ago, this port was home to half a dozen processing plants.
And they're all gone. We're the only ones left.
These days, only 7 boats head out to sea from Fort Bragg to trawl the bottom for Dover sole, cod, whiting, and similar species. That means business is slow next door to Kaidos, where Tommy Ancona's fishing supply store has been in business for 40 years.
People always say this, oh my God, the fishing industry's gone away, it's gone away. Well, you know what, you got to kind of think back at how it's evolved.
Back in the heyday, he says, fish were treated like they were giant redwood trees or gold, something to be extracted for quick profit. But in the past couple of decades, rules designed to stop that over-exploitation inevitably meant cutting back on the number of boats.
We're down to a core group of fishermen now.
5 years ago, many fishermen who trawled for groundfish agreed to give up their boats for a lump sum of cash. That dramatically reduced the size of the fleet. There are now only about 160 bottom trawlers left in California, Oregon, and Washington. And the ones who remain, though by constitution fiercely independent people, now work within a very complex set of rules and regulations.
It's not a wide open industry anymore. It's all highly regulated. And so, you know, if there's anything going wrong, it's in the management.
And Kona says there are things going wrong, so he's part of an effort to change the management rules, which are set by a federal commission called the Pacific Fishery Management Council. Thanks to the council's efforts, the fish are doing okay, he says. It's now the industry that's in trouble. 200 miles up the coast, Randy Smith is gearing up his bottom trawler in Crescent City. His boat is one of just 3 at this port that still goes out for groundfish like sole.
Where's that boom cat?
I don't know, buddy.
With a heavy beard and a baseball cap, this 51-year-old fisherman says things are good for him personally.
Right now, trawl fisheries is actually better than I've ever seen it. There's more fish now than any time in my life.
That's basically because there are far fewer boats out there trying to catch the fish. Even so, Randy Smith's share of the catch didn't increase as much as he expected when he agreed to buy out his colleagues. That's partly because the allowable catch factors in a certain amount of waste.
Right now we're on a 2-month quota. We're given so much fish that we can catch in 2 months, period. Well, that creates waste because when you meet the quota and you go over the quota, you got to throw fish away.
Dead fish just get dumped overboard. Smith says he can't help that if he wants to work within the rules.
The net's on the bottom and you can't see it. And if you tow for 15 minutes too long, you could have too much fish.
To address that and other problems, the Pacific Fishery Management Council recently approved a major change to the rules. They're instituting a new scheme called Individual Transferable Quotas. Here's how they work. Smith will get a quota he can fill throughout an entire year, so he'll only have one deadline to worry about, not 6. And he doesn't have to catch all the fish himself. He can buy, sell, or trade quotas. So, for example, if he accidentally catches too many Dover sole, he can get on the radio and buy shares of Dover quota from another fisherman, instead of dumping his fish, dead, back into the sea. Randy Smith says whether it works for him or not depends on the details, which are yet to be worked out.
I don't know if it's going to be a good or a bad thing yet.
The whole thing makes him uneasy about the future.
I have 5 kids, and none of them are going to go fishing. I mean, I could still make a real good living, you know, and some of the kids went to college and stuff, but I don't know where things are headed. I don't like it.
It's not just the change in fishing rules that worries him. He's concerned that more and more areas will be declared off-limits to bottom trawling, since the nets can disturb delicate cold-water coral on the seafloor. Back in Fort Bragg, the potential rule changes are also worrisome to Jim Kaito at the fish processing plant. He expects that about half the fishermen who get the quotas will eventually just sell them off, leaving the fleet even smaller than it is today.
You shrink it down that small, the boats are going to have a lot of fish to catch. There's no question about that.
But there may be only 3 or 4 boats left in Fort Bragg to provide him with groundfish throughout the year.
You know, it could be that our vessels here sell their quota, or at least their quota to someone in Oregon or Washington, want to retire, get out of the business, and we're left with no fish. And if we don't have groundfish, I mean, we won't be here to do crabs, salmon, because without groundfish, you won't be able to stay in business.
He says the fishing port simply can't get much smaller and still hope to survive. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Yeah, so I have to segue from...
You have to segue from, you've just finished hearing the fish flapping on the shore.
No, it's actually back at the packing plant. So let me think, what would be a good segue?
Well, frogs aren't...
I know what to say. Yeah. So we're going to continue along a sort of biblical plague line here because we go from the fishes to the frogs, which
Wait a
is...
Fishes weren't part of the plague.
No, I said sort of.
Sort of. All right, you can have that one. Go ahead. Transition minus, but go ahead.
Well, when you think of fishes, I think of frogs.
Okay.
And we're going to hear a story, not really much of a story. It's actually just an observation by a fellow who records wildlife, in this case in Australia. And he was driving across the outback in Australia after a rain shower in a desert area and came upon this fabulous sound of a whole collection of frogs. I call them a mob of frogs. And he's going to tell us what he's hearing and what it means.
You got to listen to this. It's amazing.
A little bit inland in Queensland, we're driving through very dry country, and I heard this incredible chorus of frogs in a pond beside the railway line, and I thought, wow, this is good. There are 11 species in this recording, and the bigger frogs have the deeper sound and the smaller frogs have the higher pitch sound. It's interesting how you can sort of signal out the different sounds if you listen carefully to let you know that there are quite a number of species calling. A lot of people are not aware that only the males call, not the female. Female only calls when she's distressed and she's about to be eaten or something like that. But all the sounds you hear of frogs is only the male. They're just advertising for their mate, and they're letting other frogs know nearby that this is my territory. So it's very competitive. So when you get a large chorus of frogs, that's what's happening.
Who let the frogs out? Who? Who let the frogs out? Who?
That's a remarkably good imitation. I don't know what species that is, but it is awfully accurate.
That's it.
Well, that's the podcast for this week. I hope you enjoyed listening to Joe and Richard and myself. And if you want to do it again, well, in a week, we'll have some more stories for you.
Hope so.
This is Christopher Joyce at the NPR Science Desk.
Joe Palka. Bye-bye.